Welcome to the Malefactors Register podcast. In this episode we present three stories of murder, perhaps its worst, senseless killings without motive or explanation. Our first story is the tragic tale of a young runaway who falls in with the wrong crowd and pays for his mistake with his life. The second story takes place in a beauty parlor where an ordinary teen decides to make a name for himself in the worst way. And finally, we end with the story of a troubled young man whose friends choose to exact a terrible revenge.
Don't pick up hitchhikers. It's always tragic when a young man makes a bad choice and pays for his foolishness with his life. Those of us who may have momentarily strayed from the right path before finding our bearings on the road to manhood should look at the sad tale of Jeff Mays, whisper a prayer of thanks and say, "But for the grace of God go I." Jeffrey Mays was a straight-A student until he discovered pot. Marijuana, while not physically addictive like cocaine, nicotine or heroin, can cause psychological dependence in some people. Some pot smokers find a special bond with the drug that makes it hard to kick. Jeff's marijuana use caused problems at home, and in February 1983, the 17-year-old Preco, Alabama teen decided to run away with his high school buddy B. Landrum. The two of them left Alabama in B's 1973 Maverick with $8, some food and a buck knife Landrum took from home. They headed west to look for work and along the way picked up hitchhikers to help pay for gas. One of their fellow travelers, John Sly, suggested that they spend the night in the Salvation Army dorm in Lafayette, Louisiana. In the dorms, Mays, Landrum and Sly hooked up with Robert Drew and his friend, Frank. The next day, February 21st, Sly left the group to sell plasma and Mays and Landrum agreed to take Frank and Drew to Franklin, Louisiana, about 30 miles from Lafayette. When the crew got to Franklin, Frank visited his bank and then treated everyone to pizza and beer. He filled the car's tank and gave Drew $65. Mays and Landrum agreed to take Drew to Houston and they headed west. Passing back through Lafayette, they picked up John Sly once again and continued toward Texas. Mays was driving, and everyone else was drinking beer when they picked up a fifth hitchhiker, Ernest Pieraluski. After the group smoked a joint, Pieraluski announced that he was on the run, and that he had served time in prison with Charles Manson. While Drew and Pieraluski got along okay, Mays was apparently unnerved by the new hitchhiker. At a stop for gas and more beer, Drew took the keys to the car and he and Pieraluski went inside. Landrum said later he noticed that they were talking and pointing at the car. He suspected that they had hatched a plan to rob the others. The group drove on for a while when Mays announced that he was going to stop to make a phone call. After returning to the car, he told the riders that his father had suffered a heart attack and that he intended to go back to Alabama. In fact, Mays never called home, but used the stop as a ruse to get rid of Drew and Pieraluski. Drew sucker-punched Mays in the face with a closed fist and accused him of lying to avoid going to Texas. Adopting what Sly later referred to as a mean mood, Drew said a prayer for Mays's father and convinced the teen to resume the trip. Things had clearly changed among the travelers. Holding a knife on Landrum, Drew said, "I ought to cut your throat in a second." He repeated this threat to Sly, saying, "I am Scooter Trash and I'll cut your throat this second." After they had driven on for a few minutes, Drew ordered Mays to pull over. Pieraluski, who had earlier borrowed Landrum's buck knife, grabbed Sly and ordered him from the car. After they got out, Pieraluski threw Sly against the trunk and demanded his money. When Landrum tried to get out after them, Drew turned to him saying, "If you try anything you are dead." After robbing Sly, Pieraluski gave him a shove and told Sly to get your ass out of here. Pieraluski and Drew ordered Mays into the back seat and told Landrum to drive. Drew and Mays got in the back and Landrum later testified that Drew was hitting and punching Mays in the face and throat until his blood splattered on the door and seat. Landrum also testified that Drew repeatedly told Mays that he was going to die and chastised Jeff for bleeding on his leather jacket. drew white blood on Landrum and licked Mazer's blood off his hands, while telling him that nobody gets blood on me for nothing. At this point, about 10 p.m. on February 21st, Piraluski ordered Landrum to stop the car and told Drew to rob Maze. They took his wallet and watch and made him get out of the car. Landrum testified that before the car pulled away, Jeff said something under his breath or something like, "You are not going to get away with this," or "You are on the run," or something. His attackers got back out and forced Maze back into the car. Landrum stated that one of the men said that he should have kept his mouth shut and now he is going to die. The men debated about who would kill Maze before deciding that they would both do it. Landrum was ordered to pull the car to the side of an access road on I-10, where they pulled their victim out of the right side of the car. Watching through the rearview mirror, Landrum saw Drew pull Maze's head back and make a slashing motion across his throat, while Piraluski stabbed him. Landrum stated that he heard Jeff's lungs or something, and that it sounded like letting air out of something. The killers rolled the teen's body down the side of the road. Maze sustained 7 stab wounds to the left side of his chest and 6 to the right of the midline. He also received 2 cutting-type wounds on the neck. 3 stab wounds penetrated into the chest cavity and were lethal. 2 of the wounds penetrated the left lung and 1 pierced the pericardium of the heart. It was the 3 chest wounds that caused the death. Landrum drove on to a service station where the older men bought some beer. One of the beers was used to wash off the buck knife. When Piraluski said he wished they hadn't had to kill Maze, Drew responded, "I fucking enjoyed it because it got blood on my leather." The car reached the Houston area in the early morning of February 22nd, stopping first at a nightclub called the Booby Rock. Piraluski said he was going to find a homosexual to rob and went into a bar. That was the last Landrum and Drew saw of him until he was arrested later. About 3:45 a.m. while Drew was driving on Kirby Drive near Rice University, he was pulled over for speeding and failing to use a turn signal. The officer noticed that Landrum was extremely nervous and that Drew had blood on his clothes. When Drew produced Maze's driver's license, the officer became more suspicious. He approached Landrum and noticed that he was very, very pale, very, very nervous, almost in a state of shock. When the officer learned that the Maverick was possibly a wanted vehicle, Mazer's body had already been found and the clerk who sold Drew the beer called police after seeing the blood on his clothes. They were arrested. What followed for Drew was a fairly routine death penalty trial. He was convicted and sentenced to death after the jury heard that he had previously been on probation for marijuana possession but had violated the terms of that probation by leaving South Carolina, breaking into the home of a man who fired his wife and stabbing the man in the chest. Drew managed to plead the crime down to a misdemeanor with the promise that he'd leave the state. After Piraluski pleaded guilty to the murder of Jeffrey Maze and was sentenced to serve 60 years, he executed a sworn statement claiming that he alone committed the murder. The courts rejected Drew's requests for a new trial and none of his pleas for habeas corpus were granted. He claimed to the moment he died that he was innocent. When the last of his appeals failed, his sentencing judge signed Drew's death warrant with a smiley face, which upset anti-death penalty advocates. The judge defended the move, saying he had signed all of his orders that way for years. For those looking for a bit of vengeance, they may be satisfied that tears streamed down Drew's face as the lethal cocktail was pushed into his veins. It appears that at the end, despite the tattoo on his arm that proclaimed he was Big Bad Bob, Drew was just as afraid to die as Jeff Maze. Some guy named Smith. In 1966, Richard Benjamin Smith read the newspaper articles about Charles Whitman and Richard Speck and decided that he had finally found a way to make a name for himself. Smith was an invisible high school senior in Mesa, Arizona who had never stood out in any way. His grades were average, he was a B student, and he did not distinguish himself in athletics. In fact, when Smith burst onto the front pages and reporters scrambled for some insight into his twisted mind, the only notable thing about Smith was that he wasn't notable. He seemed to come from an average family where he was the oldest of a pair of children, one boy and one girl. Father was a retired Air Force officer who worked in the defense industry and mother was a homemaker. Smith's younger sister was all of 5 years old in that year of mass murder. Obviously something was wrong with Richard Smith because early on a warm November morning in 1966 he walked into the Rose March College of Beauty and Mesa and ordered the 7 women and children there, 5 adults, a toddler, and a babe in her mother's arms, to lie on the floor like the spokes on a cartwheel. Then he proceeded to shoot them with a .22 caliber target pistol. 5 of the victims, including 3-year-old Deborah Sellers, died. Her 3-month-old sister, Tamara Lynn, survived because her mother, Joyce, shielded the baby with her body. As if a mass murder was not indicative enough that something was not right with Smith, when his father contacted police to tell them that Smith was missing from his home, he was told that his son had killed 5 people. "I was afraid of that," he replied. "The carnage could have been much worse. If Smith had arrived at the school 30 minutes later, there would have been around 40 women present for the class. Most, but not all, of the women would undoubtedly have been shot. I'm sorry, but I didn't bring enough ammunition for them," Smith told one of the women when she warned him that the beauty school would soon be quite busy. Smith's first plan was to suffocate his victims by placing plastic bags over their heads, but he resorted to the pistol when he found that the bags he brought with him were too small. Joyce Sellers and her 2 daughters weren't supposed to be at the Rose March College of Beauty that morning. Joyce patronized the college because her future sister-in-law, Mary Margaret Olson, was taking classes there. Normally she had her hair done on Friday afternoons, but her babysitter was rehearsing for a church pageant and was unavailable. Instead she waited a day and took the girls with her. She was the last to enter the school before Robert Smith came in. Not surprisingly, no one noticed Smith at first. The women were busy setting up for class and were startled into submission when Smith fired a round into a large mirror on the wall. He then herded them into a back room and ordered them to lie on the floor. It was perhaps a minute or two after 8 a.m. The women's reaction to the crazed, but calm gunman, clearly shows that 1966 was a much simpler time than today. They greeted Smith with incredulity. "We thought he was kidding," Bonita Sue Harries told police later. "We asked him, 'Are you kidding?' He put the gun against my head and said, 'No, I'm not kidding.'" The first to die was 18-year-old Glenda Carter, an orphan who had been passed among relatives until she had settled in Mesa 2 months earlier. "She was a real sweet kid and got along with everybody," her roommate later told Pete Hamill, who covered the story for the New York Post. 2 weeks earlier Glenda had been named Student of the Month. Her portrait and poem she selected were posted in the front window of the school. Bonita Harries said it was someone praying that apparently set Smith off after he told the women they were going to die that day. Some of the girls were crying, and Mary said to him, "Are you serious?" He said yes, and then she started praying. He asked what she was doing and Carol Farmer said she was praying, "If you don't mind."
"Yeah, I do mind," Smith replied and shot Glenda in the back of the head. Next Smith shot Bonita Harris, who pretended she was dead so that he wouldn't fire again. "He laughed a lot and talked like he was weak in the head," Bonita recalled for police. When the shooting stopped, Glenda Carter, 18, Joyce Sellers, 27, Deborah Sellers, 3, Mary Margaret Olson, 18, and Carol Farmer, 19, were dead. Carol Farmer lived at the nearby Air Force base while her husband was on duty in Alaska. In addition to being betrothed to Joyce's brother-in-law, Mary Margaret Olson was a cheerleader as well as a singer in the local high school choir. Further bloodshed was averted because one woman, Evelyn Cummins, one of the college's teachers, had stepped out of sight to answer a phone call. "I heard a man's voice and then a popping noise," she said. Looking around the corner she saw Smith with the gun. She ran next door to an auto parts store and called police.
The first officer responded just 4 minutes after the shooting started. By that time Smith was finished. He didn't have anything in his hands, said Officer Gary Johnson, the first responder. I didn't draw my gun. I went inside and he said, he shot some people back there. The gun is over there. Johnson pushed Smith back into the college and there were the bodies. The baby was crying and the mother was lying across the child. She had her arms around the baby, so you could tell she was trying to save her. Smith offered no resistance and was quite talkative when questioned. I wanted to get known, he said. I wanted to get myself a name. Once in the criminal justice system, Smith was quickly judged sane and went to trial, where he was convicted of 5 counts of premeditated murder and 2 counts of assault with intent to commit murder. The jury didn't take much time to hand down the death penalty. On appeal, however, the verdicts were overturned on a technicality and a new trial was ordered. This time Smith pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 5 life terms. In the end, he failed in his attempt to make a name for himself. People remember his role models Speck and Whitman, but a person will have to drill down pretty far on Google to find a reference to what's his name, that guy who killed a bunch of defenseless women on a Saturday morning in 1966. Throwbacks. Every now and then someone commits a crime that is so barbaric and shocking it defies explanation. No crime is acceptable, of course, but most can be explained with some kind of rationale, albeit twisted and faulty. Others leave us so-called civilized types scratching our heads and wondering whether Cesare Lombroso was right when he posited in the late 19th century that criminals were some sort of atavistic throwback to an earlier stage of evolution. When confronted with the crimes of the murderous father and son team of Clyde and Nathan Rutherford and their accomplice Stephen Staylor, there doesn't seem to be any other theory that fits except that these 3 men, who beat a 19-year-old family friend and buried him alive, are simply inhuman. The Honorable Justice Wolfson, presiding over their appeal before the Appellate Court of Illinois, succinctly expressed the viewpoint of the criminal justice system. Accepting an invitation to stay at the Rutherfords can prove fatal, the justice wrote in his introduction of the opinion for a unanimous court in upholding their lengthy prison terms in 1995. He concluded the decision by stating, "This was managed slaughter." In 1991, Stanley Brown, 19, was living at the Rutherford home on the north side of Chicago. It wasn't unusual, the court found, for Nathan Rutherford to invite troubled friends to stay with Nathan and his mother and father. It was March when Stan showed up to live at the house in the 4500 block of Tristana. 16-year-old Stephen Staylor was already living with the Rutherfords, but Stan's presence created no apparent problems. In April, Stan went missing. By May it was obvious that he was dead. In June 1991, police officers, aided by construction workers with a backhoe and shovels, found Stan's body laying beneath the dirt in Schuyler Woods. His hands were tied in front of him and he had clearly been beaten to death. The first indication that something was wrong occurred in early April when Stan failed to show up at a regular team meeting that he attended. On April 18, Clyde drove Nathan to visit the team's former girlfriend in Wisconsin. When she greeted Clyde, Nathan and Staylor, she asked where Stan was. Nathan showed the girl a stained baseball bat and indicated, "Stan's there." Nathan claimed the brownish splotches on the bat were made by Stan's blood. The next week, Clyde picked up the girl and brought her back to Chicago. While she was in the Rutherford home, Nathan showed her a cognac bottle that contained a substantial amount of brownish liquid. Nathan again said the liquid was Stan's blood. On Mother's Day weekend, Nathan, Clyde, Staylor and the girl went to Nathan's grandmother's house in Salem, Wisconsin. As they were leaving, Nathan and Stella waved out the window and shouted, "Bye, Stan." The girl asked them what they were talking about. They pointed out a swampy area near the house and told her, "Stan's there." In reality, Stan wasn't really there. At least, not all of him. His corpse was buried in a shallow grave at Hidden Hill in the Schiller Woods Forest Preserve. By mid-May, Stan's mother had filed a missing persons report. Nathan's girlfriend was also troubled by his strange comments and the odd way that Stan had simply dropped out of sight. She talked things over with a friend who convinced her to go to the sheriff. The Kenosha County Sheriff took the baseball bat the girl had been given as a gift and analyzed the brown stains. The tests showed that the bat was stained with human blood. Armed with that evidence, the authorities got a warrant and started looking around the marsh near the grandmother's home. They found the bottle with about 3 ounces of human blood in it. Chicago police and the Kenosha County Sheriff's Department were already talking about Stan's disappearance. The Chicago authorities brought the three men in for questioning. Clyde was the first to break. On June 1st, after about 2 hours of questioning, he told detectives his version of how Stan died and where he was buried. On June 2, 1991, the Chicago police contacted the sheriff to let them know that Stan's body had been discovered. The autopsy the next day revealed that although there was evidence of lacerations on both sides of Stan's badly decomposed head, he died of asphyxiation. There was dirt and gravel in his mouth, esophagus and lungs. He had been buried alive. That same day, police executed a search warrant on Clyde's residence and truck. Police recovered a piece of plywood and a piece of particle board, both containing brownish stains, a guitar, on which the markings SD4291 were written in a brownish substance, a metal baseball bat, a wooden bat with nails driven into it, a pair of blue jeans, and a Metallica t-shirt. Later, a criminalist for the Chicago Police Department testified that her tests revealed that human blood was present on the plywood board, the baseball bat, and in the brown glass bottle. Also, the markings SD4291 was written on the guitar in blood. Clyde refused to provide police with a written or recorded confession. In his interrogation, he blamed Stella for the killing and said that he and Nathan had dropped Stella and a badly beaten Stan off at the woods. Stella had a shovel and Stan was carrying a car battery, and later Stella joined the two Rutherfords in delivering newspapers for the Sun-Times. According to Clyde, when Stella joined up with the father and son brain trust, he was alone and without the shovel. "Where's Stan?" Clyde reportedly asked. "He got scared and ran off," was what Stella allegedly told him. Stella and Nathan told a different, more gruesome tale. According to Nathan's confession, late in March 1991, Nathan discovered that a misprinted $5 bill he owned, valued at $600, was missing. After Nathan kicked Stan in the face and broke his nose, Stan admitted taking the bill and agreed to return it. Unfortunately for Stan, he had damaged the bill and ruined its value, sending Nathan into a violent frenzy. A day or two later, Stan threw a beer bottle at Nathan as he was entering his graffiti-filled bedroom. Nathan took the beer bottle and hit Stan on the side of the head with it, causing a deep cut that bled profusely. Nathan continued to beat Stan with his fists, kick him, and throw objects at him. Stella joined in pummeling the victim and later started beating Stan with a wooden handle from a toilet plunger. According to Nathan, after a 10-minute assault, Stan was very out of it. As Stan sat leaning against a wall of Nathan's room, Stella collected blood from the cut on Stan's head into a bottle. Nathan admitted that he took a baseball bat and rolled it in Stan's blood as a souvenir of the incident. They threw the nearly unconscious victim into a shower and then discussed how to get rid of Stan when they realized he was probably going to die without medical help. The teams knew that taking Stan to the doctor would result in their arrest, so they quickly discarded that option. It was approximately 11 p.m. and time to begin Clyde's paper route, so the boys decided to take Stan with them and bury him in the woods. They helped him downstairs and with Clyde's approval, loaded the dying teenager into the bed of Clyde's truck. Clyde drove them to the woods where Stella took Stan into the woods and buried him. All three of the conspirators confirmed that Stan was forced to carry a car battery which Stahler had intended to use to help destroy his body. Stahler pleaded guilty and received 45 years. The only defense witness during the Rutherford's trial was Nathan's mother, who testified that she had 10 other children and that some of her other sons had contributed to the graffiti on the walls of Nathan's bedroom. Clyde's first trial resulted in a hung jury, but he was subsequently convicted on retrial. He received a 27-year term, while Nathan received a 42-year term.
We hope you have enjoyed this podcast of the Malefactors Register. For more true crime stories, visit the Register online at markgribben.com. These stories were written by Mark Gribben and read by Peter Gray. This podcast was produced by Jeffrey Barnes. I'm Rachel Johnson. This podcast is copyright 2011 and may not be rebroadcast without permission of the copyright holder. The Malefactors Register podcasts are available on iTunes. Until next time, goodbye.